day and welcome to the OFA Brown Bag Webinar Series, Fatherhood in the Inner City. Today's webinar is being recorded. There will be a question and answer session at the end of today's call. You may submit your questions online through the Q&A pod located at the top right-hand corner of your screen at any time. If you would like to ask a question over the telephone, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Damon Waters, Office of Family Assistance. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning and welcome to Fatherhood in the Inner City, the second in a series of informational brown bags sponsored by the Self-Sufficiency Branch of the Office of Family Assistance. Today we have with us one of the preeminent scholars in poverty, welfare, and families. Dr. Kathy Eden is one of the nation's leading poverty researchers who uses a mixed method approach as she works within the domains of welfare, low-wage work, family life, and neighborhood context. As a national magazine reported, Dr. Eden has spent much of the past several decades studying some of the country's most dangerous, impoverished neighborhoods. Dr. Eden has witnessed firsthand the lives of the people she studies. From her insightful look at the lives of children in poverty, and there's a lot of month, to her addition to the early welfare reform era discussions with her looks at how low-income mothers make ends meet in the low-wage workforce and how they navigate a world of limited opportunity, Dr. Eden has informed much research, caused much fruitful debate, and encouraged a closer look at how poverty impacts the lives of those often trapped in its grip. She has taken on key mysteries about the urban poor that have not been fully answered by quantitative work, including how do single mothers possibly survive on welfare, why don't more go to work, where are the fathers, and why do they disengage from their children's lives. Her most recent books, Promises I Can Keep and Doing the Best I Can, weave together an understanding of the lives of low-income mothers and fathers and seeks to redefine the public discussion about poverty, welfare, fatherhood, and family. As stated, Dr. Eden has authored several books and several journal articles. Her book, Making Ends Meet, How Single Mothers Survive Welfare and Low-Wage Work, was one of the highest-selling volumes ever published by the Russell Sage Foundation. Her new book, Doing the Best I Can, Fathering in the Inner City, just published in May of 2013, talks about unmarried fathers in the inner city of Philadelphia and Camden, New Jersey, on how economic and cultural changes have transformed the meaning of fatherhood among the urban poor. In January of 2014, Dr. Eden published a section in the Shriver Report entitled What About Fathers, where she discussed the diverse issues facing low-income men faced with becoming a father and building a life and family. Formerly professor of public policy and management at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, Dr. Eden currently serves as the professor in the School of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Eden, I turn the conversation over to you.
Thank you so much, Damon, and I'm really happy to be talking with you all today. I know that many of you are experts on these subjects in your own right, so I look forward to learning from you during the Q&A that will follow my presentation. Let's go on and let's go ahead and advance to the next slide. So, the goal of this study was to really examine the problem of father absence among unmarried men. And at the time we began the study, the public discourse about these men was really rich. Next slide. So we begin here with a quote from David Blankenhorn, sort of on the right side of the political aisle. Unmarried fathers never signed on to anything. They never agreed to abide by any fatherhood code. They've never had any explicit obligation to either their children or to the mothers of their children. Next slide. Also on the right, William Bennett wrote in his book, The Broken Heart, that it's unmarried fathers who are missing in record numbers, who impregnate women and selfishly flee. And it is these absent men above all who deserve our censure and disesteem. Next slide. But moving to the left of the political aisle, we hear from Bill Cosby. No longer is a boy considered an embarrassment if he tries to run away from being the father of an unmarried child. And next slide. Our own president, right before he was elected, made the following statement at the Apostolic Church of God in Chicago in his annual Father's Day sermon. too many fathers are missing from too many lives and too many homes. They've abandoned their responsibilities, acting like boys instead of men. We need fathers to realize that the responsibility does not end at conception. We need them to realize that what makes you a man is not the ability to have a child, it is the courage to raise one. Next slide. So the common diagnosis that we're hearing across the political spectrum is one of unmarried fathers not caring, of sort of hit-and-run fatherhood, of fathers who impregnate women and selfishly flee. And what we really set out to do here is to figure out whether lack of caring was the correct diagnosis or whether something else more complex and more profound was going on. Next slide. So what we learned and what frankly stunned us, and I'll tell you a story about this in a minute, from our 8 years of conducting ethnographic observations with 110 men in Philadelphia and Camden, was that in the broader culture, fathers have become more involved in their children's lives than ever before. They've really adopted this new father model where they're caregivers and not just breadwinners. And what we learned from the interviews we conducted with these men was that they had an incredibly strong father thirst. They wanted to be different from the generation of men that had raised them. They wanted to be there, not just be paychecks. They wanted to be active parents, watching, being there to observe the first steps, the first words. They really wanted to be 100% dads. Next slide. So, ethnography is a very valuable tool, but representation of the general population is always an issue. So I'm going to turn to demography for a minute, to a nationally representative data source. I kind of moonlight as a demographer when I'm not doing ethnography. And there's actually a lot of evidence that our men are actually acting in the way that they talk. They talk about when we interview them in their communities. We know that the vast majority show up at the hospital now and participate in the birth of their child, or at least show up in the waiting room to visit that child. We know that the vast majority are voluntarily claiming paternity. They're not being forced to claim paternity, but they're voluntarily do so, often at the hospital. Surveys tell us that about 80% of unmarried fathers claim they're together in a romantic relationship when they're there at the hospital, and the mothers agree. About 90% of the men and 75% of the women say, in fact, there's at least a 50-50 chance they'll marry the child's other parent. And 98% of fathers say they plan to be involved in their child's life. So from both the ethnography and the demography, we hear this the story of desire to really engage in the lives of their children. Next slide. So if you can advance the slide, I want to tell a story from the fieldwork of the first young man we interviewed when we first moved to Camden in the late 1990s to begin this study. We asked Andre Green, who was a teenager when he became a father, to describe the moment that he heard the news that he was going to become a dad. And he tells the story of his Aunt Charlene meeting him at the door, saying, "Hey, you know that girlfriend you used to have?" He would say, "Yeah, what about her?" And she said, "Well, she's pregnant." And Audrey relates the story of how he acted all put out in front of his aunt, in fact, slamming his fist on the counter of the kitchen and stomping up the stairs to his bedroom, slamming the door as if really upset, and then sort of looking around, you know, to make sure none of his cousins were in the room. And then he says he began to dance around the room shouting, "Thank you, Jesus." Now, when we first heard this story, we were stunned. We thought he was an anomaly. We wondered if he was a little bit crazy. Could he, his reaction possibly be a common one? And when we began to ask Andre why he responded in the way he did, he really talked about the power of a child to ward off the negativity that he felt everywhere in the community. His brother had just lost his life to the streets, in fact, and his mother had returned to a drug addiction to sort of cope with the loss of her oldest son. He also spoke of the desire to redeem the past his own painful childhood where his father was absent and, to quote him, had children all over the place. So Andre describes this process in which hearing the news that Sonia was pregnant sparks this desire to do better than his own father had done for him. And as we began, next slide, to interview more and more men, not all were as enthusiastic as Andre, but the vast majority were either calmly accepting or downright happy to hear the news. In another study that we conducted, we found that fathers were, in fact, more excited than mothers were to hear the news of a pregnancy. Next slide. So just to give you a flavor of these data, again we say, so what went through your mind when you first heard she was pregnant? Robert says, well, I was excited, but then he realized he had to get out there to support her. Ozzy simply says, well, I always wanted one. James said, when I first found out she was pregnant, everything changed. I was like, I don't care if she's cheating. And at first, I was so happy. Wilbert, I was so happy, even in the back of my mind, I wondered, is it mine? Stephen gave a response that was the most typical. It was as if we were asking a strange question. Well, of course, I was glad it was no major obstacle. Let's go ahead to the next slide. A few more examples of responses. Stephen says, it was my first son. I really look forward to having him. George said, you know, I love you. I'd love to have a child with you. Amin says, even though I was not in love, I wanted a son. And we're going to hear from Amin a bit later. Next slide. So one of the key questions, of course, was, what was your reaction when you first heard the news? But another question we were really surprised by the answer to was the question, what would your life be like without your child? We thought men would say, well, if I didn't have a kid, I wouldn't be having child support dogging me. I would be a CPA by now. I would have a chance. I wouldn't be giving all my income away to someone else. But instead, we heard responses like those that follow. Next slide. So Kevin says, I'd probably be in jail. Q thinks he'd be dead. Mike also thinks he'd be dead. And he says, it's given me something to fight for, something like a destination. I got to go somewhere. Apple says, kids give you something to live for. John feels more like a man. Seven says, I couldn't imagine being without them. Because when I'm spending time with my kids, it's like, now that is love. That is unconditional love. It's like a drug that you've got to have. Next slide. Again, we see from our white fathers, talk of jail, talk of getting high, talk of being dead without one's kids. It says, as if kids are life preservers. To quote Bill, I'd still be out there. I'd still be out on drugs and such. I think about my kids now, and there's just this hope of getting a good relationship with them. Next slide. And here are some quotes from our Latino fathers that very, very much echo those of our white and black fathers. I probably would have been dead, Carlos said. I probably would have been dead a long time ago. I have friends that have died from overdoses of drugs, AIDS, and so on. I would have ended up like one of them. Next slide. So we asked Elvis, next slide, what did you think your future was going to be like before you had him? He says, I wasn't going to live past the age of 30. And then once you had him, he says, I can't even picture my life without Elvis in it. He named his son after him. I had already made a promise to myself. I had told my friends I did not want to live past the age of 30. If I made it to 30, I'm going to take myself out. He came into that picture when I was like 27, and all that changed. My whole life changed. Next slide. So similarly, we asked Lacey, next slide, what would your life be like if you hadn't had your children? I can't imagine that one. I really can't, because my life without them, it would be empty. It would be empty, because that's what kept me going, knowing I had to come out of jail and be there for him. How did you see your future before you became a father? I didn't have no future. I didn't care. I lived for the moment. Did you think you would live to see 42? No. Nobody expected me to be there to see 17. Did you imagine that you'd be doing something career-wise? No career. I'd be a big gangster. Next slide. Nelson Rios summed it up when he told us, having kids, it's like a drug that you've got to have. Next slide. So the good news is that if we believe these men's accounts, children may have a tremendous power to transform young, disadvantaged men's lives, to give them a sense of hope, meaning, purpose, to use one father's words, to give them a sense that they have a destination, something to go to, a reason to stay employed at that low-wage job. My computer just kicked me out. I'm just logging back in. Okay, but the bad news is that the process of relationship formation, which I'm going to describe to you next, makes the odds very long that a father will remain closely connected to his child throughout the child's life course. And as we'll show, what men end up doing, the way they end up accomplishing fatherhood or slaking this father thirst, is through serial selective fathering. And this is a highly uneven pattern of fathering that involves intensive investments in young children, often with little or no investments in older children. And we'll talk about the implications of that at the end. Next slide. So let's look more carefully at this process of relationship formation. Next slide. Let's go to what men say about the courtships with their children's mothers. The courtship is a probably not the right term here, but in men's own language, there's no real language for describing this period in the couple relationship. So we turn first to Amin Jenkins, who we heard from before, and he describes his courtship with Antoinette, his son's mother, in this way. Well, my youngest son's mother, I met her at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. She was attracted to me when I first saw her and I made my approach. We began to socialize and then communicate, and from there we began to affiliate, and at some point in time we became intimate and my son was born. So there are two notable things about this quote. First of all, what is not in this quote is any mention of love or commitment. In words, bureaucratic language like socialize, communicate, and affiliate sort of take the place of those terms. Also, the lack of intentionality with regard to the process of becoming a father is also evident in Amin's account. Now, Amin is African-American, but let's go ahead and turn the slide to a young man from the Fishtown section of Philadelphia, John Carr, who is Caucasian. He says, actually, she was dating a friend of mine, and somehow she wanted me, but it was my friend's girl, so I didn't want to have nothing to do with it. But then my friend heard some shit and started talking shit, saying he would kick my ass, so I was like, whatever, then I will be with your girl. Eventually, I got stuck with her for a little while. So again, John Carr doesn't choose Rayanne to be the mother of his child. She's just the woman he happens to be with, he happens to sort of get stuck with at the time a child is conceived. Let's turn now to a young man from the Fishtown section, go back just one, Tim O'Brien, of the Kensington section of Philadelphia, again a Caucasian respondent. He says, I was hanging out at a friend of mine's house, and her and a couple of her friends were there, and then she used to go out with my friend. My friend was trying to get back with her, and I ended up getting with her. We were only together for about 2 months, and she was getting pregnant. I didn't mind at all. And what's notable about Tim's response is that although 2 months is relatively fast, even among our sample, the modal amount of time before the first pregnancy leading to a live birth in this sample and several others is only 6 to 7 months. So these are very, very tentative relationships at the time a child is conceived. Next slide. But what we find is that the news of the pregnancy has tremendous transformative power. We might even think of these as shotgun relationships, because it is really the announcement that a baby is going to be born that forges the relationship. The relationship isn't forged beforehand with the child as is sort of the outgrowth of the relationship. It is really the news that a child is going to be born that coalesces these tentative liaisons into something more like what men call a real relationship. So let's go to Will Donnelly in Fairview. He says, I had just come out of a juvenile institution. I think I just turned 17, and I started going with her friend. And then one day she came around, and we started talking, and then I went with her and left her friend. And me and her got together and started having kids together, and then we got closer and closer. Then we started living together. So in Will's world, getting closer and closer and living together are things that are accomplished after pregnancy, or in his case, even after he and his child's mother start having kids together. But what happens once pregnancy occurs? Next slide. So David Williams describes his courtship with Deborah prior to pregnancy as follows. When I was first with Deborah, I had a girlfriend on the side too, Kathy. She's someone that I met at an NA meeting. We got close and we were helping each other with our addictions. One thing led to another and we got intimate. Me and Deborah would get into an argument. She'd tell me to leave. I'd go stay with Kathy. So how'd you end it with Kathy? Deborah got pregnant, and I had to do what was right. So, again, he isn't really choosing Deborah. He's ending up with her. But what happens when the pregnancy is announced? Next slide. Each month of the pregnancy, you know, we got closer and closer. I wanted to be with her more. And then, like, 2, 3 in the morning, she had me running to Pathmark buying different foods. So that brought us a lot closer, too. And then watching him born brought us even closer. On her last push, he came out spinning like a bullet. Nothing was more beautiful than Julian. The way he came out of his mother, that was amazing. And I held him, and I didn't want to let him go. Next slide. So the process of relationship formation we document in Doing the Best I Can is one of accidental conception. Most men say when we ask them about the state of the relationship or whether they were planning to have a baby at the time the children were conceived, say, I just wasn't thinking at the time. And only a tiny portion, less than 1 in 5, say there was intentionality involved. There's more reason to worry about the process of relationship formation because the relationships with the women who become their children's mothers are often highly tenuous. Short courtship, little selectivity. I just got stuck with this for a while. It's a fairly stark statement and maybe on the end of the spectrum, but still this sense that you end up with a person who becomes the mother of your child is very common. Pregnancy is what prompts the real relationship, but in essence, what these men see as primary is the father-child relationship, not the mother-father relationship. And so what they're really going for is a way to solidify their connection with the baby and not necessarily the mother of their children. The third reason to worry is that the situations these men are in are often highly tenuous at the time. Their employment is unstable. They're often still in a pattern of ripping and running the streets, and this lands them in prison and jail and with parole and probation violations. Many report substance abuse problems, and unstable housing really presents a barrier to visitation as well. So we have a context of sort of extreme risk, even though men show this strong desire to father their children. They're doing so in very, very fragile circumstances. Next slide. So the consequences of this pattern of relationship formation is that even though 80% come to the hospital saying they're together with the mother, and most say there's a good or at least a 50-50 chance they're going to get married, half of these relationships end up dissolving in the first year and more than two-thirds by the child's 5th birthday. After these breakups, we document a pattern of highly contentious co-parenting. Men and women then go on to repartner and have subsequent children with their new partners. And these competing obligations lead to obligation overload for some of our men. When moms transfer into new partnerships, they often begin keeping the fathers away, and we have both quantitative and qualitative evidence of this, not because they're necessarily mean-spirited, but because they're desperate now to keep the new relationship together. And when the new love of their lives is constantly being confronted by the old, There's a lot of drama in the household and a huge amount of conflict between these two men. So sometimes in order to keep a new relationship intact, women feel they have to really push the dad of another biological child out of the picture. And I can talk more about maternal gatekeeping in the Q&A. Next slide. So rather than the typical family looking like this, and this is kind of, I think, what we had imagined before we got this rich demographic data that showed the extent of complex families at the bottom end of the income distribution. Next slide. Many men are enmeshed in families that look like this, so this just kind of represents the obligation overload they may be facing and the sheer complexity of managing all of these ties. Next slide. So to draw from a nationally representative data source, the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, we asked fathers, tell us about the child you're most involved with. And we have both fathers that have their children with one mother, and those fathers who have children by more than one mother. And we see in both cases a very high rate of intensive involvement with the child they're most involved with. Even among those with multiple partner fertility, we see a rate of 85%, and it's over 90% for men who have all of their children with one mother. So that looks pretty good, but if we turn to the next slide, what we see is that when we ask fathers to describe the child they're least involved with, I think we skipped a slide there. Try going up one. Yes. We see that fully half of fathers report that they're involved very little, if at all, with another of their biological children. So again, they're being saints to one child. Well, they could rightfully be called virtual deadbeats to another one of their biological children. Next slide. So here's a case in point. This is David Williams, who we quoted earlier. He's very involved with his son Julian, who's now one, and Deborah's two children from a prior relationship. Those children's fathers are in jail. But he has no relationship with his two sons, age 12 and 13, from ex number two, and has only sporadic visitation with his 17 and 18-year-old daughter on holidays. So if you look from Deborah's perspective, or from the perspective of the household he's actually participating the most in, he's super dad. Well, he's a real failure if you look from the point of view of his other four children. Next slide. So the bottom line is the process of relationship formation puts fathers on a family go-round. And more importantly, for policy, it puts children on a father go-round. And this often leaves them with no adult male that ends up investing in them throughout the early life course, all the way through high school graduation and into college. When their mothers transition to new partners, those partnerships are often always fragile, leaving kids sort of moving from one parent to another and with little long-term investments and a lot of trauma over the repeated separations that they experience. Next slide. So what should we do? I think we've maybe underestimated the power of information that we could put into the hands of young men. Sometimes I joke that we need a national campaign for early and unplanned childbearing for men, and people at the national campaign say, well, we're gender neutral here. We want to serve both. But many times I think we approach the problem of pregnancy intentionality by giving information to women and not to men. I was doing a presentation for the child welfare folks in New York City, and a young father was on the panel with me, and I raised a suggestion. Someone in the audience said, well, these young men's brains aren't yet fully formed. How can they possibly benefit from information? And my co-presenter, this young father, Elliot, stood up and said, you spent 6 years teaching me about STDs in sex ed class. Why didn't you tell me about child support? And why didn't you tell me it would be so difficult to stay engaged with my child if I didn't have a good relationship with his mother? So we might want to think about prevention strategies that, to take a line from Jens Ludwig's intervention in New York called Stop, Look, and Stop, Look, and Listen that has proved so effective for keeping young men from reengaging in criminal activity. There should find ways to get men to think about the process of family formation in a more intentional way and in a way that could satisfy their father thirst more fully and perhaps not lead to this pattern of serial selective fathering we see. Second, we should capitalize on father thirst. We should capitalize on the potential for childbirth and fatherhood to really transform the lives of men. And, of course, we could talk in all kinds of ways about improving access to children. But as fathers say, the worst thing that they experience, and this is not true in all jurisdictions, but it is true in most, is that if you're not married to the mother and the child and you get a child support order, there was no automatic process granting you parenting time. They call this taxation without representation, and to them, this really makes them feel that the state is treating them merely as a paycheck and not as a parent. They often sometimes, frankly, feel that the state and the public at large views them as predators, and they feel they have a real role to play as parents. Next slide. So I'll end with that. As you'll see, there's a discount code here for participants if you go to the University of California website. There's also a website, Doing the Best I Can, which shows lots of images of these dads with their kids, plus other material. Perhaps some of the folks I'm talking to here, we have links to some of the things that they're doing. But I'll end there and open it up for questions, and thank you again for signing in and listening.
As a reminder, everyone, you can submit questions online through the Q&A pod on the top right-hand corner of your screen, or you can press star 1 if you are called in this afternoon, and you will be placed in the queue to answer your question. So, operator, if there's anyone in the queue now, we can start with phone questions first.
And we have no one at this time.
Well,
all right.
Kathy, while we wait for questions to come in from our audience, we have some here that maybe can spark some additional questions for you. Given the current labor market and some of the challenges that you talked about with regard to getting these individuals, these men, economically stable, what are some additional recommendations to help them get those formal skills, that formal education, and also navigate those social relationships that they have? If they have that multi-partner family and they have all those kids and everything, and dealing with that psychological trauma that they're definitely having to deal with, what are some of the things some insights you can offer on how to help programmatically these men address all of that?
Yeah. So, you know, the failure of these young men to stay involved in their kids' lives is almost overdetermined. They're facing such tremendous obstacles. And what I didn't mention is trauma from the family of origin. Many of these men had really difficult childhoods. And, you know, this is an era in which their own fathers often didn't stay involved. And, you know, their mothers might have been struggling with unemployment. They may have been working all the time and leaving the kids to raise themselves in order to make ends meet. Substance abuse also really affected this generation of parents of these men in ways that left real scars on their children. So they bring with them this tremendous fragility. They do experience tremendous difficulty in the labor market. One thing I'd like to point out is that we talk a lot about the minimum wage, and that's very important. But what's really the fundamental struggle these men face in the labor market is not being able to get full-time work. Low-wage employers have decided that they don't want to hire people full-time, and in fact, there are incentives for them not to do so, but they really expect 100% availability. So the ability to take two jobs is really limited. So, you know, we've got dads who are trying to raise families on a 25-hour-a-week McDonald's job. There's willingness to work. Even men without criminal records really find it hard to find the kind of full-time work that even if only money at minimum wage or close to minimum wage, could nonetheless help out a lot. So that's a real struggle. But I think what ends up happening is that poor prospects plus traumatic childhoods can limit men's ability to persevere. And that's where children come in. If we could figure out a way to really capitalize on men's desire to be good dads, and really what they want to do is they want to participate in the everyday aspects of parenting. They want to put the hair in twists. They want to bring their daughter to church. They want to, you know, take a son to water ice. They want to, this is a Philadelphia treat, you know, Italian ice. They really want to be there. You know, they want to read to their kids before bed. They want to do, in many ways, what they want to do is what mothers have, the roles mothers have been typically assigned. And as long as we, by really treasuring and honoring their desire to be more involved in practical ways, I think we could really strengthen their resolve to persevere. Many of us wouldn't be able to persevere in the circumstances they end up in. So it's going to take a lot, and children seem to be the most meaningful thing in these fathers' lives, and the point of the transition to fatherhood seems to be a real magic moment we could capitalize on more.
So we have questions coming in online as well, and the first question we have is, for those fathers who may be on public assistance, what is the best way for social workers to reach out to these fathers and get them not only involved in their families, but enrolled in supportive services to get them out of the social service system?
Okay, so very few men of our men were on public assistance. Some were, you know, the laws were changing around that time. But this is a hard problem. You know, public assistance pays, as you know, very little money. I'm not sure how to answer that question. Certainly the men that we've talked to who find themselves on public assistance would like to work more conventional jobs, but these are, of course, the men with significant barriers. So, you know, it's very hard to imagine, given the limitations of the policy environment we're now in, what we might do about this. Certainly providing public jobs might be one solution.
And then to follow up on that question, we have a question regarding what available tools or recommendations might you have for those practitioners that are working with fathers on relationship formation?
Well, you know, basic information, for example, on the impact of multiple partner fertility on child support could be helpful. You know, you all know this, you're more expert at this than I am, but you know, the percentage of your income you're going to pay for three children across three households is much higher than what you're going to pay for three children in one household. It's a key piece of information that fathers don't seem to have. They know about child support, but they don't know about the intricacies. And when they end up with a child support order of close to 50% because they've had three kids across three different households, that becomes unsustainable. Also, if we taught men, and some states are actually doing this, right, in high schools, if we taught men about parenting, about, you know, their importance in children's lives, but perhaps the most important thing we can do, frankly, is to convince the women in their lives that they're important. The theme of maternal gatekeeping that I mentioned earlier is really significant. Mom often not only wants to keep her new relationship together, but she can be lulled into thinking that this new dad is going to be the father her child really needs, and you know, it's kind of okay to push away the biological dad. She often trades up in partner quality, so it's tempting to think that that part-time electrician she's now with is a little bit better than the unemployed caterer she used to be with. You know, so that's another reason for gatekeeping. But oftentimes it's, you know, I spent my early career studying mothers. I'm you know, all four single mothers, but oftentimes they you know, don't have a strong sense of the importance of the men in their lives. And really the only way to keep father involved is, you know, is to get over sort of this drama in the household when two men are sort of competing for the same child, both the social father and the biological father, is to have that mother in there playing a nurturing and supportive role. Complex families are complex, however, and in the end, if fathers can think and be more intentional about their pregnancies, we may see less multiple partner fertility if we can use some of the insights of cognitive behavioral therapy to get men to engage in what economists call slow thinking rather than fast thinking. And that's what the intervention in Chicago I mentioned, the Stop, Look, and Listen intervention, is focusing on. We can not only get men to commit less crime and graduate from high school more often, but perhaps we can get them to be more intentional about their pattern of family formation as well.
Do we have any questions coming in through the phone?
Not at this time, but as a reminder, that is star one.
I just wanted to mention one more thing while we're waiting, and that is that ultimately this is about hope. I mean, the reason children become so important to men who are in such desperate circumstances is because that's all there is. They're really grabbing onto children to make meaning.
All right, we have three additional questions, and the first one I'll pose to you. Many of these fathers will be hourly workers and have opportunities to work hours that are evenings and weekends and cannot be available for their children. We are addressing the concerns about money, but what has the research foundation about scheduling logistics?
Yeah, so this is a big problem, right? And this is kind of an interesting he said and she said in the data, because my prior book, Promises I Could Keep with Maria Kafalos, was about the single mothers in these communities, so the partners of these men. And what moms really expect from men is, you know, dependability. They want men to visit at a regular time, and they want them to show up when they say they will. These are all reasonable things. But the chaos of men's work lives, and, you know, what's really interesting is that this is part of a larger study of 440 low-income men in four cities. Even men who appear to be unemployed are working at something, right, because nobody's willing to pay the bills of the man. Men are expected to support themselves. So they're not only, you know, working at hourly jobs, but they've got all kinds of hustles to get by. They may have a ladder, you know, a paintbrush, a drop cloth, and a grocery store cart. And they may work on the weekends doing side jobs as painters. They may buy equipment and do extermination or power washing on the weekends. So they have all kinds of things they're doing. And this really makes their visitation patterns very catch-as-catch-can, which, of course, infuriates mom, and especially if she's trying to build a firewall between her ex-partner and her current partner. Many of these guys are forced to see their children in the context of the mother's household because they don't have stable housing of their own. And, in fact, if there's one thing, after doing all this work, I would say is just a really crucial problem we've overlooked is the problem of housing for these men, especially the kind of housing that would allow them to have overnight visits and really spend one-on-one time with their children outside of the purview of the mother and the mother's new partner. So, again, if mothers and fathers could be brought together, if co-parenting strategies, you know, oftentimes in fatherhood programs, we're limited because fathers are the ones that are coming through the door and we can't really deal with the couple. But really what we need is a couple-level intervention where mothers and fathers can see one another's point of view. Father can understand that mom needs more stability in the pattern of visitation, but mom also needs to understand that fathers are working multiple jobs that are highly contingent and unpredictable. And if those points of view can be reconciled, and if we can figure out a way to get men more access to stable housing, some of these problems can be eased.
Thank you. And our next question, in what ways, if any, can we help shift the paradigm in relationships from the clinical, non-emotional, to the relational and intimate with commitment?
Yeah, so that's a very, very good question. What's interesting is when you talk about the relationships these men have with their children's mothers, and you ask them about it, it's rare that the words love and commitment come up. And so that's really striking, right? But if you ask men about marriage, not only will they tell you that they want it, but they'll tell you that they're waiting for a soulmate. In fact, one man in his 30s, Ernest Green, said that the kind of love he was looking for, you know, was that crazy love. And to roughly quote him, he said, where you stand out in the rain, under the window, in the dark, waiting for her light to come on. So men have very romantic notions of finding a soulmate. And what's poignant about these accounts is they really fundamentally don't believe they will find a woman who will love them through thick and thin. They just think their own circumstances are such that they're going to be rejected by the women in their lives. Also, you know, they have these highly romanticized ideas of what they want in a partner, but they tend to have children with whoever happens to be around at the time that a pregnancy occurs. So the plain Jane, who is one's child's mother, is just not very likely to end up being, the woman of their dreams. And so they often really separate the notions of my soulmate from my children's mother. Many of these men have very few role models, as you can imagine, of these kind of soulmate relationships. So this is possibly part of why they become so romanticized. One thing the state of Oklahoma has done is it's put married and unmarried low-income couples together in their relationship skills classes. And it's really striking to watch the unmarried couples. I've visited the state many times. How these unmarried couples sort of relate to these young married couples. All of these are Medicaid. These are folks that had a Medicaid birth. And to really see that people like them can make it and can have a committed relationship is really inspiring.
Thank you. And the next question, fixing the taxation without representation piece by entering parenting time orders is one thing that child support programs can do to improve working relationships with young fathers. Given the child support mandate and core purpose, what other things can these particular state-run programs do to flex and meet the needs of men not living with their children so they stay more engaged over the long haul?
Yeah. So one thing I think, child support has a limited budget, but forgetting that for the moment, turning the child support agency into an agency that serves couples and families rather than an agency that serves women and sees men as the enemy is the goal here. And there's a lot of, history to be overcome. In some ways, the child support system we have now was made for the generation of men before this one. There was a generation of men. We have documentation in both survey data and in ethnographic data from prior generations who really did cut and run, who really didn't maintain contact with their kids or even desire it outside of the context of the relationship they had with the children's mother. And our current child support system still operates on that assumption. What we need to think about is a more nimble system that doesn't try to force men to care, but takes advantage of their desire to care. So one example is in-kind child support. Almost all men prefer to give in kind than in cash, and they often prefer to buy things that are either highly symbolic of their care, like Pampers and tennis shoes, Pampers and wipes, that allow them to come over often. Like if you're constantly supplying the Pampers and the formula, right, you get to visit, you get to stop by all the time. Fathers love this. And that when the children are older, they like to give things that go directly to the kids. So that pair of tennis shoes becomes, you know, a constant reminder to their son of their care and their you know, and their love for that child. So by sort of making, you know, child support sort of makes the provision of parental paternal care invisible, right? It takes it right out of the best paycheck and funnels it right to the mom without sort of ensuring or facilitating any kind of direct relationship between the father and the child. And so building on this, it's kind of the magic of in-kind child support, might give us some purchase. Are there ways that fathers could be credited with caring for their children more directly via the child support system? Are there a way that agreements between moms and dads could be made so that in-kind items could be regularly offered in lieu of some of the cash that fathers owe? Are there ways to build up this fragile family rather than tear it down via, you know, sort of the blunt, you know, the blunt state? Treating the process as a process of, you know, building up the fragile family rather than, you know, soaking the blood under the stone to benefit the child, I think is where we need to go. And a lot of folks in the child support world know this and are eager to try.
All right. And our final online question we have regards Native American fathers and if you have any statistics on them.
I don't. I really apologize, but I don't have any data at all on Native American populations.
All right. Do we have any questions coming in over the phone line?
Not at this time.
Thank you.
And you have a question over here, Ellen.
Great.
Hi. This is Julia Conte. I'm in the Office of Family Assistance, and I am wondering, can you talk a little bit about what these fathers see as their role in the lives of their non-biological children? So when they're living in the household with a mom who might have a kid from another father, do they also feel very connected to that child, or what does that relationship look like?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So it depends, and it mainly depends on child age and the participation of that child's father. So if a guy we looked at David Williams in that stick figure graphic I showed, David came into Deborah's kids' lives when they were fairly young, and they don't have an ongoing relationship with her own dad because he's incarcerated. And in fact, the little daughter asked David if she could call him dad, and this just broke him up. You know, he said, "Man, maybe I'm better than I think I am, but this child would ask me to be her dad." And it's a very, very touching moment in his life, one that he cries while relating it to us. But men can be very, very attached to their social children, and they get a lot of credit from the mom because this is a relationship in which they're not obligated to give anything. So they're sort of given extra credit for what they do for their social children in ways that actually they don't get for their biological children. The problem is when that relationship breaks up, mom seldom views it as legitimate for that dad to stay involved. So we have dads who have really taken on social children as their own and seek to make no distinction between their bio and social children within a household. If the relationship breaks up, and suddenly mom won't let that man talk to his non-biological child on the phone or have any contact. So this is kind of a heartbreak for the men. You can see the mom's position. You know, he's enough trouble. I'm not going to, you know. The co-parenting relationship is often so poor that these relationships end up going by the wayside. And this is why I think the father-go-round is so deleterious to kids. Even if you do bond with the social father, that bond is likely to be ripped away when when mom and dad break up. So these highly unstable, highly complex families that have really proliferated at the bottom of the income distribution pose real challenges for fatherhood, not only of biological children, but of social children as well.
And just before we wrap up, Kathy, if you could just give some quick insights about where you see the next phase of research and programming with regard to responsible fatherhood and family formation, relationship skill building, what recommendations you could make on how to increase or improve the economic and the social stability for these very, very fragile families and fathers?
Well, I have, sort of my pie-in-the-sky recommendations and then some more rubber-meets-the-road recommendations. I do think that we can work very systematically throughout all of our social institutions to send the message that really there are no single mothers. And if you look at the data, this is true. And in the Fragile Families and Child Well-Being Study, which is a nationally representative survey of urban births beginning in 2000, you see only 4% of women staying stably single throughout the child's first 5 years of life. So if we change our point of view and realize that these really are fragile families and not single mothers, and we begin to incorporate the fathers in every way that we can, just, maybe in, it's a radical sort of change of vision, but it's one that doesn't really require money. It just requires attentiveness. So that's kind of a very simple thing we can do. Pie in the sky would extend the earned income tax credit to dads, or maybe even more generally to singles, because everyone deserves to make a living wage if they're willing to play by the rules and go to work and work a significant number of hours. But I think this co-parenting piece is really, really key, as is the prevention piece. So those are two new areas I think we can really push. And how do we get guys to plan their pregnancies? Can we get them to stop, look, and listen with pregnancy just like they do, we've gotten them to do for crime? And can we find ways to bring mom in and to create an environment in which mom is dad's friend and facilitator and not his adversary?
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Eden. You've given us definitely a lot of information, a lot to think about, and we really appreciate you taking the time. We appreciate everyone for calling in for the Brown Bag. Encourage everyone to join us for the next Brown Bag, which will be scheduled on July 9th at 12 p.m., and will feature Dr. David Pate and focus on toxic stress among men and boys of color. Stay tuned for more information on that Brown Bag, but coming off this presentation by Kathy, we'll definitely get a better insight into what's going on up in the mind of some of these low-income men, especially the men and boys of color. So, again, on behalf of James Butler and the Office of Family Assistance, thank you, Dr. Eden, and thank you, everyone.
It was my pleasure.
Have a good day.
Thank you, and again, this does conclude today's OFA Brown Bag webinar series, Fatherhood in the Inner City. We do appreciate your patience.